5 FM and WBAI.org. Coming up next is Hour of the Wolf with your substitute host, Ken Gale. So stay tuned. All right. Why isn't this going?
Must be the next one. Turn on the light.
Oh, no. My CD went blank. I was so looking forward to playing this.
No, it's not blinking.
Well, this is Ken Gale, and Jim Freund is not in today because I'm not sure why. But anyway, I'm going to be substituting for Hour of the Wolf, and I'll be playing comic book stuff, except this time I'll be interviewing, and I have two absolutely wonderful people to talk to. And I'll have them introduce themselves so that you have voices to go with the names. Jim, let's start with you.
No, ladies first.
We are doing ladies first. He said you.
I'm Jim Salicrup. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cuts, a publisher dedicated to producing great graphic novels for all ages.
I'm Shelley Mayer. My grandfather was Golden Age cartoonist, editor, and writer Sheldon Mayer, and I am the direct result of what happens when you're raised by a cartoon, which I was. And I sculpt and animate and doodle and write on stuff and make clothes and play with everything.
Okay, let me see this song.
Cyclops, angel, and Doctor Strange. I want to be like them from the age of 16.
Be a comic book hero, flex my muscles on the beach. I wanna be
All right, that's better. Some of our equipment works when you want it to, and some of our equipment does not work when you want it to.
Yeah, send WPAI more money.
We definitely need more people to repair equipment. I don't know what happened there, but the bottom line is it did finally play. And that was the Tearjerkers, a band out of Belfast that did that song decades ago. See, I was using it as the theme to Enough Said back in 1993, so the song certainly predates that. And so anyway, back to our guests. Now, Jim has worked at Marvel Comics for 20 years and is now editing a whole bunch of different kinds of comics. And Shelley's grandfather, Sheldon Mayer, is one of my favorite people in the entire history of this art form. There's no doubt. Also, one of my favorite people. I got to interview him for DC back in 75, and we got to become friends and used to call him every once in a while and got a lot of writing advice from him. Amazing man. Guest of honor at my convention in 78. And basically, every single female staffer fell madly in love with him. And Jim, you knew Shelley, right?
Sheldon? No, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, well, you missed out.
Exactly. There are people you're aware of who are alive the same time you are. Like, and I lump him together with people such as Dr. Seuss and many others that I wish I could have met him. I probably had the opportunity, but I somehow it just never worked out, and I regret that.
But we got to share Irwin.
Oh, very lucky. So I've been very, very lucky with so many people I've gotten to know, so many of my
heroes.
Irwin Hazen, who is probably best known in New York for the guy who illustrated the Dondi comic strip, which was on the back page of the Sunday News for throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, and he was quite a character in his own right. And Shelley could probably talk more about him than I ever could.
A lot of personality into that little body of his.
Yeah, and he was good friends with your grandfather, right?
They were best
friends. Very best friend. Yeah,
he babysat my mom, and he would come over a whole bunch, and he worked on the Flash under him. They used to get into T-square fights on the desk in the offices that Infantino got to witness on his first interview. It's like, what am I into?
That's right. Carmine Infantino, who is one of the great Silver Age artists in history of comics, passed away a couple of years ago. And in fact, I did an obituary with Robert Knight, the show before this one, way back then. And yeah, young Carmine, he's like a teenager, and he's being interviewed by, editor of DC Comics, and he wants to break into the industry. And while he's having this talk about trying to get work, all of a sudden, Irwin comes running in, and they have a sword fight with T-Squares. And then, sword fight's over, Irwin leaves the office, and Sheldon Mayer gets back to interviewing this young artist.
But it was a long one, I heard, like 30 minutes of...
I didn't hear it being that long, or maybe it's lengthened over time. Or, but yeah.
I hear Carmine was, "What am I getting myself into? I gotta get out of here."
Yeah, and he later became the publisher of that company he was interviewing for
as
a teenager. But it's interesting because in the 70s and 80s, people used to describe Marvel Comics as being that kind of place. People are roller skating down the hallway and filling their offices with crumpled paper. And
I think sometimes, like the way people say the best year in comics is the year when they were 11 years old, reading the comic books.
Right.
I think.
And the golden age of baseball is when you're 13.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, the period that they worked in comics is always looked back fondly as, that was the best of times. And because being there 20 years, I managed to be there through several different, incarnations in a sense. And, I enjoyed every different version. They all had their, pluses and minuses, but it's when you have creative people, you don't want to, you know, have an environment that's like a bank or an insurance company. Not that I have anything against that, but you know, you want to. I when people sometimes ask me what an editor does, I say it's to create an environment that's conducive to creativity. So whatever it takes, you want to keep artists and writers happy and motivated, and you just have fun. If it's like if the creators of the comics aren't enjoying what they're doing, then how can the audience possibly like it? I mean, the reality is creating comics is an incredibly difficult task, and the artists, the writers, they have to spend all the people working on it, the letterers, the colorists, have to spend incredible amounts of time working around the clock by themselves, isolated. So when they get together, you know, they're going to want to have as much fun as possible.
But somehow in the middle of working isolated by yourself and not meeting, there has to be a continuity which is created. And it's not super easy to do.
And I'm also thinking about that 20 years of Marvel went from the early 70s to the early 90s. And you saw a lot of changes in the industry.
Well, as a kid, I had two dreams, basically. I was growing up in the Bronx, and it was during the 60s, which was a very turbulent time. And my dream was to live in Manhattan, and the other dream was to work for the Marvel bullpen. And by the time I actually got in, even though I was 15 years old, the Marvel bullpen that I dreamed of working for was already sort of fading away. You know, Stan was promoted.
Stan Lee
was promoted to publisher. Roy Thomas was the new editor-in-chief. But it still had a lot of the people I as a fan, just worships, you know, from John Romita, Maurice Severin, Herb Trimpe. It was like, you know, I felt like, I guess the musical equivalent would be if I was a Beatles fan and I was somehow won a contest and got to be a roadie or something, or or be a flunky in Abbey Road Studios and be there, you know, with my gods. And so I enjoyed that tremendously. And, you know, it was just great fun for me. The changes, just to answer your question.
Yeah.
So from the very beginning, when I started, it wasn't quite what I imagined, but there were these people I admired so much. And over the years, it got bigger and bigger. And for me, it was sort of like school, and a school that I actually enjoyed attending. And I got to, you know, learn a lot just by being there, listening to Stan Lee or Roy Thomas or even, you know.
What were you learning?
Like an example would be, you know, when it comes to coloring, you know, every kid gets a coloring book and some crayons, and you figure, you know, trees are green and the wood is brown, the sky is blue.
Shelley's shaking her head. She knows where you're going.
Well, so the idea that there were these different concepts of coloring, you know, there was Stan Lee had very definite ideas. He's, very underrated, believe it or not, as he was a great art director. And he had, you know, great design sense for covers, and he knew a lot about color. And basically, he treated covers like posters, where he wanted it to be very powerful and dramatic and effective. Marvel, in general, you know, he wanted it to feel exciting and dramatic. Whereas when Jim Shooter, an editor-in-chief who his early background was with DC Comics, had different priorities. You know, there was clarity, making sure that the characters pop off the page. So they would do all sorts of things that as a kid I would have never imagined, particularly at DC. The idea of coloring the sky pink, it would never occur to me. So just learning all, this is probably true throughout, art anyway. There's all sorts of color theory, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, there is.
But just by being around, watching, say, George Russo's, who was the cover colorist at Marvel, the whole time I was there, one of the greatest things I remember him saying is when Marvel was becoming a little bit more corporate, they, I believe the company hired some kind of efficiency person to go around and figure out ways they could make the company, make the employees more productive. So they would ask the different staff people, routine questions. And I think they asked George, how long does it take you to color a cover? And he said 40 years. and he was joking, but at the same time, it was a true answer.
Yeah, right.
In order to do as many covers, as quickly and as well as he did, it really did take that 40 years of experience. When they would bring in new people to fill in, they were lucky if they could do one or two covers, just, the first draft. And, and they still wouldn't be as great as what he was doing. So, there was, I could spend all night just talking about what I learned there. And I'm fortunate that I was able to have that opportunity, because all that information has become invaluable to me now as I'm working at Paper Cuts. Some of the comics industry, moved in a direction where they were sort of following their audience, where, so many fans wanted the stories to become more mature or more grown up or what have you, that I think we went through a period where the big publishers weren't doing that many comics that were for kids. So about 11 years ago, my partner Terry Nantier and I sort of felt, hey, there's an opportunity for us there to produce graphic novels that will be for this audience. And I'm thankful for, particularly Jim Shooter, of all people, who gave me a lot of, gave all his editors on staff a lot of instruction on how to make comics as accessible, as clear, as understandable as possible. And, make each book a separate entity that, if a kid picks it up, he's getting everything he needs to know. He's not going to feel like, he's coming in the middle of a movie and not understand what's going on. He made it very, accessible. He made this, he stressed strong storytelling, good stories, good art, et cetera, et cetera.
It's interesting that, you talk about learning from different people, and because you hear people in almost every profession, whether it's a musician or a professional athlete or a teacher or anything, that they talk about learning from people above them who had been there a while. But so many companies seem to all want to have people the same age working there. So there isn't that dissemination of knowledge from experience, and everybody is sort of learning at the same time.
It depends. I mean,
I know somebody who worked in Wall Street who was fired simply because he was over 50. And then one day, the stock market goes down, and not a single person who worked there had ever been on Wall Street when the stock market went down. And they didn't know what to do. So they called him back, and they go, "We need you." And it's sort of, I think a lot of places are like that Wall Street company, where they decide that they don't need somebody who's been around because they're old fashioned and they don't know what they're doing,
or they have to pay them more. There's a lot of
and in that case they did have to pay him more, because it's just like, well, you fired me, now you're going to hire me at a higher rate than you hired when I then. Yeah,
well, ageism exists everywhere. I got a big kick out of it. Before Paper Cuts, I spent a couple of years on the West Coast working for Stan Lee again. He had a .com called Stan Lee Media, and he had called me up asked me to be a writer-editor for him. I flew out there, actually with a broken ankle. And, you know, I had to do a lot of, you know, I've been a lifetime New Yorker, and I had to, like, uproot myself to, you know, suddenly be working in L.A. for a little while. While I was waiting to start up Paper Cuts, I needed something to do. And even though he had hired me, Stan's sense of humor is he had to do, once I arrived there, he had to do an interview with me. And he asked me, you know, how old are you? Because we're a young company, and we only want to hire young people. And, you know, Stan's 93 or 4 now, and this was like, I don't know, he was in his 80s or late 70s then. So, you know, he had a pretty good sense of humor about such things. But, you know, it's you know, like what you were talking about, I heard at a convention this past weekend, one of the editors from around the time I was at Marvel was being called back to train the editors at Marvel now. But, you know, most people, when they're thinking of comics, a lot of comic book fans, they, you know, they don't recognize how many comics publishers are still in New York. There's NBM, Paper Cuts, First, Second, Valiant, Marvel, you know, and I'm sure a few more.
Isn't Harris still here?
No, they don't do comics anymore. Yeah. But you know, there's still lots of publishing in New York, and I think a lot of these other companies do have a, you know, an age range and all that. I mean, there's when I was at Marvel, there were people of all different ages, but depending on the position. But a lot of times, young people back before the internet, and you know, which. In order to break into comics, they had to come to New York, and they would get some kind of job just to get their foot in the door. And, you know, maybe they really wanted to be a writer or artist, but they would either work in production or as an editor. And then once they, you know, they would take on freelance and try to establish themselves and then move back.
And Peter David working in marketing.
Yeah. I mean, you just want to get in the door, you know, have access, show what you could do. And some people didn't want to be, you know, in the office for forever and ever. You know, like they enjoy, you know, working at home or you know, however they want to work.
And before the show, we were talking with Matt, one of our volunteers, about comics, and we just started to approach a conversation about how people think of comics. You know, it's only for kids, even though there hasn't been many kid comics until fairly recently. There just weren't many comics for kids. And every once in a while, Marvel would try or DC would try, and it just, the line would never succeed. And now it is.
Sugar and Spike did quite well.
Now we're going back further. Because one of the things I wanted to get to when I asked Jim about the changes is in the early 70s, Marvel was publishing superheroes, war comics, teen comics, you know, Archie ripoffs and Katie Keene ripoffs, and all kinds of different kinds of comics for different kinds of people. And so was DC. And then when the comic shops started proliferating in the late 70s and the 80s, it really changed the way comics were made, because the comic shops were run by people who were into superheroes. They're the people who wanted to open up a shop where you just sold comic books, and they wouldn't order the Westerns, and they wouldn't order the war comics, and suddenly they weren't selling, and they were all being canceled. And Sugar and Spike, that was written and drawn by Sheldon Mayer. I remember on an episode of Enough Said, somebody saying that they'd seen it on Nickelodeon or something, an animated Sugar and Spike for a short time. And
the Rugrats.
Rugrats is kind of doing what Sugar and Spike was doing in comics. But when Sugar and Spike was coming out, I was a kid, so I didn't read it because that's a kid's comic. I'm not going to read a kid's comic because I'm more adult than that, and I wanted something a little older. And I gravitated toward superheroes and the horror line. And then as an adult, people started telling me, you really got to check out Sugar and Spike. And once people who I really liked and respected are recommending Sugar and Spike, I'm like, okay, let me. And my roommate, Tony Tolan, had a collection of it, and he was one of those people. And of course, he's my roommate, so I disregarded his opinions. and so while he was away visiting his parents, I'm like, let me read your Sugar and Spike comics. And I fell in love with it. And I became a bigger Sugar and Spike fan than Tony was. And so when Sheldon May was interviewed for Amazing World of DC Comics, which was their fanzine.
Issue five,
Tony brought me in to interview Shelley because I kind of quickly got more into it than he was and knew more about it. And he realized I was a pretty good interviewer. And that is what started my friendship with Sheldon Mayer. And there's an article on my webpage where I talk about Shelley as the most important person in the history of comics. Not because of Sugar and Spike, which ended up being my favorite long series comic book, but not just because he was the editor who helped guide the creation of Green Lantern, Flash, and Wonder Woman, but he was the one
and
who
Wildcat.
Told... Oh, you know, we can start going into lots of characters there. Every member of the Justice Society, pretty much. Shelley was involved in creating, he was the editor. And when he, in a way, he was my editor. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. But he also was the person who was told DC to buy Superman after they'd already rejected it. And
it's true. He had Jerry and Joe. They came to the office.
Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster created Superman.
Yep. And he thought it was brilliant. So he had him over for dinner, Jerry and Joe, with my Uncle Monty, who was the character Dinky in Why Brothers Leave Home, part of Scribbly.
Why Big Brothers Leave Home.
Yes. Did I say that wrong?
You said Why Brothers Leave Home.
Oh, Why Big Brothers Leave Home.
Big Brothers Leave Home, yes.
And he was 10 at the time, and he ran it by him, and Uncle Monty loved it, and he took it to Max Gaines, and you got to do this. And he had respect by that point, and he read through it. They had too many titles. He called Donenfeld and said, you got to print this, and the rest is history.
And it's interesting that in the last year or two, it seems people are going, no, that's not what happened. That's not what happened. I'm like... Everybody who was there said that it was a happen. It's only now that all the people who were there have passed away that people are wanting to redo the history. I find that kind of bizarre. And there are some weird ideas that people have of what was going on in the 40s that certainly are contradicted by the people who were there in the 40s.
What's that old expression, success has many authors?
Yes. Yeah, and everybody wants to claim credit, just like... you know, in music, everybody wants to claim credit for Led Zeppelin. And it's weird some of the ways that people claim credit for Led Zeppelin. So it's like we're with everything else. But
I wasn't born then, but I feel because I have the initials JS that I have in some way helped create Superman as well.
Well, he wasn't the kind of man that needed to tell everyone what he accomplished either. It wasn't until he passed that I realized how much he had his hand in, and he didn't stand on a mountaintop and say, look what I'm doing.
Yeah,
so it kind of enabled other people to walk by and go, hey, I did that, because he was just off doing it. He didn't need to tell people that he was doing it.
And his style of teaching I got to enjoy because when I would ask him questions, he had a very Socratic way of teaching. He didn't just give me the answer. He would basically draw the answer out of me. When I would talk about, the philosophy of writing, and he knew. I mean, he had asked me my opinions of various stories, so he knew that I knew what a good story was because I would talk about it in other people. But he had made me talk about it in my own stories, and he made me draw out what makes a good story. Period. Whether one of my favorite writers was writing it or one of my least favorite writers was writing it, because I certainly complained about other writers to him, or whether I was writing it.
So what makes a good story?
Characters.
Yeah,
characters.
What makes a good character?
Realism, a feel for humanity, a feel for dialogue.
Developed.
growth. I feel like I want to give examples, and then if I'm starting to give examples, then I'm not talking to Jim Salicrup and Shelley Mayer.
Well, you
examples
know,
are good.
I'm going to be teaching a class on comics publishing at NYU this summer, so if I could steal ideas from you, why not?
Oh, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Dun, dun, dun.
And I'm Ken Gale, and I'm substituting for Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf. And my guests today are...
Shelley Mayer.
And Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
and Julie it's Schwartz funny, and Jim Shooter right? And all the other JSs in comics. It's the most common initials in comics, I think.
John Severin.
Yeah.
Joe Sinnott. And me, Jim Salicrup.
J.D. Spurlock.
It is interesting, the weird coincidence. Like, but I mean, there's got to be some initials that are the most common. It just happens to be yours.
John Smith.
and of course, Shelley is an artist in her own right. I mean, while Jim was talking, she's got a sketch pad out, and she's filling it with all kinds of doodles. Although not as intricate as some of the doodles I've seen in your other sketchbooks.
She had to do something to stay awake while I was talking.
That's how I stay still. I used to do math problems with the glass in churches, because when we were on military bases, we had to go to all different churches to learn different philosophies. And when the sermons got crazy, I would create different patterns from the amount of colors they were. And if I moved them around, I could create this picture, and then I drew it. And that's how I could stay still.
She's actually passing notes about you, Ken.
I remember when I interviewed Fly.
Fly Orr?
Yeah, and a couple other people from World War III Illustrated.
I like her.
And while I'm talking to other people, she was drawing me. And it ended up being in one of her Peeps compilations. And there was a convention where this guy was sitting across from me, and he ended up drawing me during the convention and presented me with a drawing, which is now on my website. And that person is now sitting across from me. There's a Jim Salicrup drawing.
Yeah.
A
Lousy Sketch is their official name.
With smelly markers.
Yeah. If you go to comicbookradioshow.com is my website, and if you go to the host page, there's photographs, but there's also a drawing by Jim Salicrup.
Well, I'm very honored that it's there. I started doing
He's got
these,
me holding a microphone, which I wasn't at the time.
I started doing these lousy sketches. Well, part of my, when I was a kid, part of the reason I wanted to get into comics, like all other kids, is you want to be a cartoonist. And I will now reveal how incredibly dumb I can be. When I got into Marvel at, age 15, and I was just, it was the summer before I was enrolled in the High School of Art and Design. Did I think, boy, how lucky am I to have such artists like John Romita Sr., Herb Trimpe, Maurice Severin, and many others there as teachers, mentors. Yeah. They would have been happy. No, my little egomaniac brain was thinking, I'm not worthy. I can never compete with these people. I better find something else to do. And that sort of led me on the path to, I did everything, at one time or another. Started, like, my first job was delivering the comics to the Comics Code Authority, but I did paste-ups, mechanicals, ran the stat machine, anything I could just to be like the Little Mermaid. I wanted to be a part of that world. And over the years, it was helpful. I learned a lot, and it gave me a greater understanding. But somewhere, deep inside me, I think I still wanted to be a cartoonist. And years ago at a Big Apple convention, when it was back on the church and in the basement.
59th Street, yeah.
I was next to Russ Heath. And he's one of the greatest Silver Age artists around. And, absolutely, an artist can draw anything. It's just wonderful. And he had, like, his various, prints and sketches he was doing for, it was pretty expensive and well worth it. But as a joke, I made a little sign, put it on the table that said, "Lousy sketches, only $5." And to my surprise, people started giving me $5 for these lousy sketches. And I just kept doing more and more, because to me, this was like, this was beyond amazing. I mean, nowhere else in the world. If I go into a diner and the bill comes and I do a lousy sketch, you know, they'll call the cops and I'll get arrested. But at comic book conventions now, you know, if I'm there with paper cuts and we have a booth, you know, then I'm, you know, Mr. Editor and doing everything I can to promote paper cuts. But if I'm just a guest on my own, rather than, you know, many writers and editors who just have to sit there and sign comic books, I have fun drawing these, you know, silly cartoons, or, you know, in case when I did your picture, you know, like just drawing things for fun and giving it away for free. And I enjoy that. It makes it, you know, it's like a dream, a yet another dream come true. And, you know, people are very kind. You know, they argue. They say, it's not lousy. Like, well, okay. But, you know, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and there's a lot to it. The sketches are fun. That was exactly the word. And we were now going back to the labels thing, is that when you say that comics are for all ages, people think, oh, they're for kids. Right, and you think,
well, words have lost all meaning.
And if you say that comics are for adults, they think it's adults only.
Well, they think it's pornography. Yeah,
and you know, and so there's, so yeah, these words have lost meaning. So all ages no longer means all ages; it means kids, because nobody wants to say it's a kids' comic. So you have to call it an all ages comic.
Well, it's a tradition, you know. Comic books were, you know, not all of them were particularly comic, and none of them were books. Now graphic novels are, you know, include, you know, nonfiction and any other genre. It just becomes a, you know, a name for what something is. You know, it's a category. It helps market it. So you go along with it. But all ages, my favorite example of what we aspired, you know, to be able to produce is like Pixar. They produce, you know, some great animated films that kids can enjoy. Adults can enjoy, you know. Not all our, you know, graphic novels, admittedly, you know, achieve that. I mean, some are clearly, you know, better appreciated by older audiences, some younger. But there are a few, like that I've mentioned to you, like Ernest and Rebecca, Ariel, some of our, you know, classics, illustrated adaptations, where, you know, I think they do manage to pull off that trick of being something younger readers really can enjoy, and adults are not embarrassed. You know, that they can enjoy it as well, and that's our goal. When I mentioned Ernest and Rebecca, that's an example of you know, one of the things that can break an editor's heart. Where it's not, I could talk about it as being great and not be too egotistical, because I really had nothing to do with the creation of it. It was a series created in France, and it's almost like a female version of Calvin and Hobbes. It has a little 6.5-year-old girl. You know, her parents are breaking up. She has an older sister who's becoming a teenager, so, you know, she's involved in her world. So, you know, the little girl is sort of alone and isolated. So, like Calvin, you know, is this Ernest character part of her imagination? Is it real? It remains to be seen. Mm. But I think, you know, the premise may have seemed like, oh, this is just some gimmicky type of series. But the writing is great. The stories evolve from graphic novel to graphic novel. They're funny. They appeal to kids, yet adults can, you know, these are great stories about family life and, you know, and childhood and relationships between, you know, family members. You know, my favorite volume is the one called Grandpa Bug, and, you know, the kids are going to stay with their grandfather out in the country, and at first they're completely frustrated, but they get to know him as, a real person, and he exposes them to another type of life that they hadn't experienced before, and it's all good, bad. It's very human. It's very touching. It's very, it's just a series that I love so much, and I feel like a complete failure in that, I haven't been able to make it a success. But whenever, I have the chance, like now, I start talking about it and hope that someone hears me and takes a peek at it, and I hope they enjoy it.
So repeat the name of that series?
It's called Ernest and Rebecca.
It's funny because, Jim asked me Monday evening to come on and do this, so I'm scrambling to find guests to come on at 1 in the morning and at the last minute. And Jim and Shelley both were able to come here. And so I'm trying to catch up on what Jim Salakoff's been doing for years and years since I last had you on WBAI. And
I've been keeping busy.
And certainly, Ernest and Rebecca, you had the most pride in your voice for that. Among them.
Well, I think more
You've got Neil Gaiman. You're publishing Neil Gaiman's early work, and yet you're more proud of that.
Well, it's like talking to a parent, and you ask them who their favorite child is. They'll often say, I can't choose. I love them all.
Gaiman has an audience. He's not struggling for
readership. Well, what happens is, like with children, you might lavish more attention on the one that you feel is brilliant but is struggling more, whereas the ones that are doing well, there isn't that need to dote on them. So I look at it that way. Talking about, being an editor in a way is like it's a little similar to, around 11 years or 12 years ago. Same time I was, working with Terry Nantier to start Paper Cuts, I was also involved in the formation of MoCA, the Museum of Comic and Cartoon Art. And part of the museum's mission was to, take material and provide a showcase and try to get, an audience to become aware of some of the great material. I mean, comics have been around more or less for over 200 years now. And the fact that there wasn't a museum or anything, there were all these wonderful people such as yourself, Ken, who were, really doing important work by chronicling and interviewing, these people now who are long gone. That's very important for any medium, and so much of it was neglected. Now, as an editor, another thing that I do, other than create new material and new properties and licensed material, et cetera, is almost like, finding some of the great material from the past that, for whatever reason, hasn't gotten, the respect it deserves, or people are just unaware of it, or people were like you and me when we were little, and we thought, oh, these kids' comics, they're for babies. We want to read sophisticated fare like Superman.
Yeah, right.
I'll give you an example of how
I had to be old enough to appreciate Sugar and Spike. I was too young to appreciate it when I first saw it.
The same thing happened with me, and I remember years ago reading a blog by cartoonist Fred Hembeck, and he was, it was very heartfelt, it was very sincere, and he went on at length about how much he loved the Dennis the Menace comics. And how, because this was at a time where there already was a lot of respect and recognition given to, say, Carl Barks, who did the Uncle Scrooge material. There was a period early, way back when, where he was only really known by comics fans who didn't even know who he was. He was known as the good duck artist. Whereas...
People could tell that there was a difference.
Yeah,
this person, was just better, or a better writer and a better artist, but nobody knew his name because everything said Walt Disney.
Yeah, exactly. And similar to that, Dennis the Menace in the 50s, it's hard for an audience to know this now, but was incredibly popular. The comic strip was a big success. You know, a TV show came out of it. A comic book came out of it.
And, a successful TV show.
And the comic was incredibly successful. And I've heard, you know, it was because of that success, very indirectly. It may have even led to DC wanting, you know, asking Sheldon Mayer to do a comic in that format. He came up with his own. Well, Shelley says no, so she could answer.
Well, it's autobiographical because Scribble.
Oh, no. I'm not saying he was copying it, but I'm saying,
tell this story from my conversation with Sheldon Mayer.
What, do you think it's your show or something?
It's the show is you guys.
Story.
Jack Leibowitz was it Harry Donenfeld or Urban Donenfeld in the 50s? Probably Harry. Dennis Menace was doing really, really well. And so they wanted to compete with it because that was back when there were so many different kinds of comics. And so Sheldon is thinking, well, you know, you can't just rip off Dennis the Menace because then you could
be that's what Marvel was doing with Peter the Little Pest.
Most people would. Most people don't have Sheldon Mayer's talent, for one thing. But he's saying that, you know, when Hank Ketchum created Dennis the Menace, he went into his subconscious and sort of created this character. And he can't go into Dennis Ketchum's subconscious. He can only go into his own. So he said, well, I'll do something that will meet that market that Dennis the Menace is meeting with, you know, with a kid protagonist. So he's looking at home movies of his son and his daughter, right?
My mom.
Yep, your mom and your uncle. And so he's looking at that, and he's saying, they look like they're talking.
Yeah.
He's like, but I took these movies. They weren't old enough to talk yet. I know they weren't old enough to talk yet, but it looks like they were. And maybe they were. And suddenly, he's like, that's it. That's my comic book. Two babies who are too young to talk, but they can talk to each other because baby talk is a language.
That's universal because they can talk to baby animals too.
And there's been now many articles about babies talking to each other. Quite a few articles. And when I did a Sheldon Mayer fanzine in 77, we had a New York Times article about that sort of thing. And so at any rate, he brings this to Leibowitz and Donenfeld. And they're going, are you crazy? We told you Dennis the Menace, you give us babies. So he goes, no, well, you see how you have to go into your subconscious. And they didn't want to hear it, right? They wanted Dennis the Menace. So then he darkened Sugar and Spike's eyebrows. So they were the same thickness as Dennis the Menace's eyebrows. And that and the confidence they had in Sheldon Mayer anyway made them go, okay, we'll try it. And part of the point is that eventually the Dennis the Menace craze will end. And if you have something that's original, you can make a go of it in that market, but it will survive past the craze because it is unique in some way. And sure enough, Sugar and Spike lasted until 71. And the only reason it got canceled is because Shelley couldn't see. He couldn't do sales. So he was right. He did manage to meet the market of Dennis the Menace, and he did manage to continue past the Dennis the Menace craze. To say Dennis the Menace was a craze, I think, is also a subtle put down that I don't mean to do.
No, that's okay.
I was pretty into Richie Rich, actually.
Well, yeah. I mean, there were lots of great kids' comics. I think when I read Fred Hembeck's blog talking about how much he loved the Dennis the Menace comics, it was, you know, the same experience you had, where I remember seeing them, but thinking, oh, well, you know, the gags
right.
were always, I think, beautifully illustrated. He was a great cartoonist. But I thought, you know, there were about 20 gags there.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just sort of been repeating forever. But the TV show was fun. I remember enjoying that when I was a kid. But the comics, I just figured, they're probably, you know, for little kids.
Yeah, that's right.
And then when I read the blog, there was so much more to it that I couldn't help thinking, you know, it's sort of like the same way Bruce Wayne, that fateful night, vowed that he would, you know, wage war on the underworld to avenge, you know, the murder of his parents. I felt I may not be now, may not be next week, but you know, I if I ever get the opportunity to publish those old Dennis the Menace comics in a really nice format, a hardcover book, I will do it. And fortunately, in this past year, we did it. And every time we publish something, you know, it's an act of faith. You know, there's, you know, we're really just a small company. We don't have giant entertainment conglomerates, you know, supporting us.
Right,
so
right.
We everything we do is sink or swim. And so that makes, that puts a lot of pressure on us. And each book we do, I figure, well, this may be the only Dennis the Menace collection of comics we ever do. And, I really don't take for granted these opportunities I get. And the first one, I included Fred's blog as the introduction. We got Bill Ray to write an afterword. Bill Alger became, you know, the editor of the book, and he had maintained a website dedicated to one of the cartoonists, Al Weissman. You know, Carl Barks was like the Disney artist on, you know, comics. But in Dennis, there was sort of like two fan favorites. It was Al Weissman and Owen Fitzgerald, who was also an animator. And we decided, well, let's do the first two volumes. The first one will be full of Al Weissman's material. We were lucky enough to get his son, Jim Weissman, to scan the original comics, because, you know, choose the favorite stories, write a short little introduction. Jim himself.
So Jim chose the stories that appear in it?
Yeah, in conjunction with Bill. And, you know, Jim, when he was a kid, looked incredibly like, you know, Dennis the Menace, and would appear in print ads and things like that as Dennis. And so it was just this labor of love for a lot of the people involved. They're, you know, like cartoonists you wouldn't expect, you know, from Daniel Clowes to Gilbert Hernandez of Love and Rockets, who wrote the introduction to the second volume, are big fans of these comics. You know, the art, they read them when they were kids, and they appreciated them, and they could articulate far better than I can how great these comics were. And, you know, we just had our fingers crossed, hope, you know, this would find an audience. And I'm happy to say, in this case, you know, it's doing well. You know, we got the go-ahead to move on and do some more volumes. We're going to probably...
But you're selling in bookstores. You're not relying on comic shops.
Comic shops, we rely on everyone. We rely on everything. Digital sales, library sales, foreign sales, you know, bookshop sales, chain sales, mass market, anything, you know, any way we could get what we're doing out in front of an audience. In the very beginning...
Well, I have to ask you something about the Dennis comics.
Sure.
Are any of the vacation stories in there?
That's what's up next. For the first two volumes, we were focusing on the work of the cartoonist, and we want to have a lot of variety. And the books are, you know, 192 pages. So the vacation specials were like, in many ways, like graphic novels.
Yeah, they were very thick.
They were 100-page comic books. That it had multiple stories, but if you read them in sequence, they flow from one story takes place right after the other. One of the best-selling ones was the Hawaii, Dennis the Menace in Hawaii, a vacation special, which will be our third Dennis the Menace book. Uh-huh. And so, yes, we're going to be doing those.
That's when I first got acquainted. As, you know, I ignored Dennis comics when I was a kid, for the same reasons you did. And as an adult, people in Interlac were talking about it. Harry Broadus was the first person to mention, and a couple other people, yeah, those are great. So nobody wanted them back in the 70s, so they were cheap. So I was like, all right, I'll pick one up. You know, you kind of like what they have. And sure enough, they were excellent, and I was amazed. And the artwork was amazing. Clearly, photographs of various parts of the country were used and lavishly
drawn?
Bill Alger has interviewed many of, you know, Al Weisman's relatives. And I think his daughter in particular has vivid recollection, like great memories of they went on to Hawaii. They went on those vacations. And so when we do in the third volume run that material, Bill will have tons of behind the scenes, archival or just anecdotal material, just making it that much more interesting. One, Owen Fitzgerald, who's going to be in the second volume, the artist featured, that Gilbert Hernandez of Love and Rockets fame, in his introduction says that Owen Fitzgerald is his favorite artist of humans in the comic book world, bar none.
Mm.
You know, that's the amount of and it's one of these things you don't see it at first, but when you look at their work, everyone thinks of their more popular characters, but both Jaime and Gilbert have done strips with children. I mean, Gilbert did a whole graphic novel called Marble Season, where you could see the influence that these Dennis the Menace artists had on them. And they're very excited to see the books. The feedback we've gotten from these artists is, they're very happy with how the books have come out. And
that's got to be great for you to have the Hernandez brothers, because, they get invited to conventions, so they're going to talk about it.
Well, I think they were beforehand. When I went to a signing Gilbert was doing for his graphic novel, Marble Season, he had a slideshow he put together all about the kids' comics that he grew up loving, uh-huh. and how important they were to him and how great they were. And he spoke about them brilliantly. And again, that was yet another, inspiration for me to just keep pursuing this.
When I've interviewed various people who've done kids' comics, they always have this such great respect for kids. It's not like, a lot of people, seems like the people who do TV shows for kids seem to think of kids as stupid adults, rather than young adults. And the comic book creators that I interviewed are just so respectful of kids and talk about how smart they are and how they notice things and how they may not have seen a lot of something to compare good and bad of it, but they know the difference between whether something's good or bad. They just can't articulate it. So don't try to put something over on them.
You
can't do it.
It works on so many different levels. I've met so many people, whether they're fans or creators of comics, who very vividly remember what it was like to be a child. Not always a good thing. I've had many people there, if people look down on various comics, there's a whole generation that doesn't like the Smurfs or what have you. But everywhere I go, I meet people, they'll tell me their stories. I've met so many women or gay people or, minorities or whatever who would say how important the X-Men was. For
yes,
them,
yes.
It made them feel like, maybe they were struggling in their own life, but when they could escape into this world where, it was okay to be different. And I spoke to
a lot of women who were bullied as teenagers, and horror fiction is what did it for them. Whether it was comic books and novels both, it gave them a release and a sort of a fantasize that. When they got bullied, they could sort of fantasize that they would have somebody go get them for me.
Well, even there would
let the right one in and type of storyline.
There would be people I would talk to, and they would, be very candid and tell me that maybe their childhood was very difficult. Maybe their home situation was nightmarish. But, for 1 hour a week, even like the Smurfs cartoon show became a place that they could retreat to and be happy for that 1 hour every week, and it helped them survive. I'm very, it's easy when I was younger to be, you know, all-knowing and critical of everything and dismissive of you know, children's comics or what have you. But as I've gotten older, I've really gotten a greater appreciation for, you know, comics. You know, I started out loving it to begin with, but then when you see, you know something like Sugar and Spike or Dennis the Menace, and let me just add one footnote before when you mentioned, you know, Sugar and Spike ending. One of the things, I mean, on one hand, it's horrible that it had to end. But one of the things I was happy about is there are certain, you know, comics creations that are so much tied to their creator,
right,
that you don't want to see anyone else do it.
Well, they redid it recently.
Oh, God, yes.
Teenage form, it makes me want to punch myself in the face.
We just don't
have to count that other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they can call it Sugar and Spike, but it's not Sugar and Spike.
There was a much better way to do that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I was just horrified. I saw it on Facebook, and I just like, and it's like, I was about to say, I can't believe they did it, but actually, I can believe they did it, because they don't have respect for a lot of people from the past.
DC, in its own way, kind of appeals to me on one level, is that it's almost like they want to hold on to everything.
It was a copyright issue.
Yeah,
there's trademark.
Yeah.
What they did to Scribbly also took them into a completely different dimension. Yeah. Scribbly just doesn't belong in.
Because, yeah, the trademark is through the name. It has nothing to do with if it's like what it was actually like.
Which doesn't make sense.
You could have Superman be a total nebbish. If he's called Superman, you keep the trademark.
But doesn't that defy the reasoning behind patent in the first place?
Yes, but we're talking letter of the law, not spirit of the law.
And, well,
you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org, talking about spirit of the law versus letter of the law.
Well, it's weird. I mean, I feel that way about Sugar and Spike, but in a weird way, you know, Hank Ketcham was the creator of Dennis the Menace. But these other guys,
yes,
the writer was Fred Toole, and the guys that did the comic book, I think, actually did a better job. So, you know, I'm not a purist on this, I think.
Right. No, I totally understand that.
I mean, I don't want to see anyone else doing Peanuts. You know, that was Charles Schulz, and I was happy the strip was over, when he passed.
I know I was always curious about what Scott Roberts would do if he was doing Sugar and Spike. Because his character, Patty Cake, reminded me of Sugar and Spike. And he did Patty Cake before he had ever read Sugar and Spike. And everybody kept telling him that, you must be a Sugar and Spike fan. And when people kept telling him over and over again, I think I better read this, if people were saying. And so he started getting it, and he's like, oh, my God, this is incredible. And for a while, you know, he and I would have little Sheldon Mayer fan club meetings at the Big Apple Con as he was trying to, you know, find somebody that had an issue with Sugar and Spike he didn't have.
What were you going to say, Shelley?
Oh, I think they should hire me to draw it.
Oh, well, there you go.
One of the comics that I was in love with as a teenager for identification reasons that was canceled early, which upset me greatly, was Angel Love.
By Barbara Slate.
By Barbara Slate. It was one of the only arguments I ever got into with my grandfather, actually, because they told me it was being canceled around issue 6, and I was horrified. It was the only one in this huge box that we got every week that I was completely identified with. I was like, there's more of me out there. And I can do this. And I remember telling him with my hands on my hips in typical indignant 18-year-old form that what good was it that you could accomplish all this if you couldn't get this printed? I mean, they did have a reader. I was the reader. And they should do the whole entire run and keep it going. And if he actually accomplished anything, he would do this. And I got a pat on the head and he went over to the studio.
Well, one of the things you said, Ken, that I really appreciate and can relate to is, the idea of, kids' properties, so many of them are not respecting the intelligence of the kids. And one of the things at Paper Cuts that I've fought for, since the very beginning, is that you know, I we're never going to dumb down things. I could, you know, we know how smart kids are. You know, I think the creators, the people, comic book fans, I think they retain that memory of what it was like when they were first exposed to comics. I think the comics most people remember are the ones that they read when they were very young. So we're very much aware of that and doing everything we can to make it make these books as good as we possibly can. You know, I unfortunately sometimes I drive my business partner and publisher Terry Nantier insane because, you know, when we're lucky enough that some of our titles are going back to press, you know, we've been very lucky on some titles. Lego Ninjago, for example, where it just kept going back to press. He likes to just be, you know, as a publisher, you know, he wants to be able to pull a lever and, you know, just print more. But in this digital age, it's become so much easier to make corrections, you know. So every time it went back to press, I'd drive him crazy and just try to get, you know, if I found more mistakes or figured out ways to do things better, I just want to get it in. It's like a never-ending process. It's never perfect. We just want to keep making them as good as we possibly can.
So you're saying that the second, third, and fourth printings are better than the first printing?
I think our heart is in every single one, but, you know, there have been, you know, I think, I'm not sure if it was Mark Evanier or Neil Gaiman said that whenever they would get a copy in the mail of their new book, you know, they could just flip it open random to any page and they'll find an embarrassing typo. And it's like, it doesn't matter how hard we work on these things that, you know, we struggle, you know, like the process of doing it now compared to when I started in comics is back then you actually had the original artwork in your hand. You'd get a blue pencil, and you mark it up. It would go to a production department. They would make corrections. The coloring, you had color guides. Yeah, you had these color guides done by colorists. It would be separated by, you know, these women in, you know, Connecticut, printed in Spartac, you know, Illinois. You didn't get proofs or anything. And once it went out, the next thing you saw was a printed copy. Maybe the covers. You had an opportunity to make a change or a correction. Now it's the other extreme. Uh-huh. We have to look absolutely every step, you know, now that we're doing things digitally, you know, needs to be reviewed. So when you're reading the same comic over and over again, you know, it you know, and particularly at Paper Cuts where we're doing graphic novels, so some of these are hundreds of pages long, and you know, no matter how much you love the material and you really want to make sure everything is right, it could be all the way up to the point. This happened just the other day. You know, we were sending out a book. This was one of our super genius titles, which is a graphic novel based on the WWE, you know, the wrestling guys are called WWE Superstars. And the art's beautiful. The story's great. And one of the, you know, tendencies we tried, you know, try to, you know, work as quickly and as efficiently as we possibly can. So sometimes when we ask for corrections, rather than look at the whole book again, we may just look at the pages where corrections were made. But between going from, you know, our files to the printer, there were lots of pages where the lettering file just slipped all over the place. You know, the balloons were going to it was like maybe 20, 30 pages of new corrections we had to make at the last minute. And, you know, it could have just very easily, you know, slipped by us. You know, so it's you know, a never-ending process. I used to think, when I used to read the bullpen pages, and Stan Lee would say, you know, keep your letters, when people were writing the fan letters into Marvel, keep your letters down to just a page, you know, have mercy on your bleary-eyed editor. And I thought that was, you know, just Stan, you know, being a writer, being colorful. And there have been days where I've left the office where I literally couldn't keep my eyes open. I had to, like, force myself every 3 seconds to force my eyes open so I wouldn't, you know, step into the subway track. Or
so, Shelley.
Yes.
Tell us a grandfather's story.
Yes, like that.
Just like that.
Yeah, what's it like to be a grandfather?
I have the hair on my chin that
he it's funny because Shelley's one of the few people I met first on Facebook before I met in real life.
Oh, me?
Yes. And so when we met, right, and I'm telling some of the stories of the conversations we had on the phone, and then I was like, okay, now you tell some stories. And your mind went blank at first. And I'm like, you knew I was going to ask you this question. And you went, yes, I did.
But there was hot dogs and champagne.
Well, there's no hot dogs and champagne here at WBAI, so.
Why not?
We're not worthy.
You'd get some really great stories if there was champagne here.
Well, that is true. I one time I had a guest who was drunk.
Who was that?
And I'll tell you off air.
Oh.
And I was sort of joking with somebody. It's like, you know, I really attempted to ask him a certain question, but I won't. And so the person comes in and he goes, ask him that question. I'm like, why? He's drunk. You'll get a great answer.
You thought that was coffee out there.
We used to, well, I lived with him when I was a little girl, till I was 5. And then my mom moved us out to military bases. And I came back at 17 because, for obvious reasons, I didn't blend into most of the military bases I was on.
Artists never blend in with the military.
Yeah, there were just so many of me running around there. One of the things that he made me do I love him for it because I really gave him a hard time, was I would have to sit in the same doorway on different levels of chairs to draw the floor where it met the wall. And I had to do it like from a stool and a chair and the floor and do the perspective and the same perspective every single day. Irritating. Brilliant. Because it made it so you really understand the layers of a drawing. And we used to do the scribble drawings every night at dinner because my grandma would hide our dominoes. We'd play dominoes until she came out and took them because she felt it was synonymous with gambling. So when she took them, we had to draw until we could take out our other dominoes that were hidden in the back of the closet, along with the cards that she would also take that we had to get another deck out. But we used to do these scribbles where he would make like something and I would do a face of it, and it's the way I base most of my sketchbook drawings now. If I'm stuck for an idea and I'm not on the subway to draw a person, I'll just do a scribble and see what happens. But at 17 I was frustrated that his was better than mine. Like, go figure this. You know. And I got really upset. I still have this drawing, and I took the pen and I just went all over and I just made an absolute mess and I slid across. I'm like, here. And he took a hand and he drew it sticking up with a little hat. It was on top of the scribbles and these little popped bubbles. It was a drowning man. But it really taught reflexes and how to see and an entirely different enjoyment out of like looking at the stucco. Because he would also have me do that. And you'd pick out what you saw and the patterns of the wall or in the clouds or the stain on the sidewalk. And as you're walking by, you can see characters in almost anything that you interact with.
So you were doing Rorschach tests with with a pencil. Yeah.
It's a brilliant way to, because no matter how big your box is as an artist, it's easy to get stuck. And one of the scribbly stories, one of the first ones is, you know, that he was drawing and drawing and drawing to the point where he's getting in trouble for drawing. And now he has all these pads and papers and people giving him money to draw, and you're completely stuck for an idea.
Right.
So he really taught me that you can find the ideas and the patterns and the inspirations in pretty much anything you look at.
You know, he edited that way, too. One of the things he would do is Gardner Fox was one of his main writers, and Gardner lived in Yonkers, not too far from the raceway, kind of across the highway from the raceway. And that's where I interviewed him. So I got to see the scene. And Shelley would go up Shelton Mayer would go up to his house, and they go to his den, and his den was one of the few rooms that didn't have windows in it. And they would go in there, and they would just throw out words, just random words to each other. And then they tried to go, how do we make a story using these three words? And he would do that, and they would throw out words, and Shelley would... Gardner Fox had a collection of ancient weapons, a lot like Hawkman's. And so Shelley would take a saber or something off the wall, and he'd be waving the saber, and he'd be walking up and down the den, which is a pretty small room, about the size of the one that we're in right now. So I don't know what the dimension of this room are, but it's about 8 feet across, by about 16 feet long. And so Shelley would be marching up and down, waving this saber while they were throwing out ideas. And then they would start talking about, okay, how do we unite these three words? And then they'd get together. And then once they felt, okay, we got a story out of that, and now we need another story. And they would have to do a 64-page comic book, and it would be maybe six stories, and say, well, they would have to work out six, and that's what they would do. And so they never ran out of ideas, because you've got the entire English language, three words at a time, that you get to use. And this is how they worked. So he worked with his writers the same way he worked with you and with his drawings.
He was brilliant.
Making you see things that other people just would not see, because creative people don't think like other people think.
He would whittle, too. He always had a pocket knife, and so when he was stuck for an idea, he would sit outside his studio on a log and whittle. And I would ask him how he came up with the characters, and he just said he carved away all the wood that wasn't what was supposed to be.
Yeah, the Michelangelo cliche, yeah.
I noticed when you talked about him, because his friends called him Shelley, but he signed his artwork Sheldon. I didn't know if you knew the story of why.
No, I don't know the story of why.
Because everyone that knew him did call him Shelley, but he was a contemporary of Shelley Moldoff. They were friends, and they created together.
Right.
And it was confusing, you know, which one was which, and so they drew straws to who would be Sheldon and who would be Shelley on paper. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I like that story.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about the relationship between Sheldon Moldoff and Shelley Mayer, which was great at one point and then got strained later. And his wife never forgave Shelley Mayer for something that happened, which I'll tell you off air.
He had a lot of integrity that surprises me.
Well, I think that's where the problem came from, is Sheldon Mayer's integrity. Most of the people, when I interviewed a Golden Age writer or artist, and even if they didn't work for Sheldon Mayer, I mentioned his name, and their eyes would light up, and there'd be a big smile, and the entire conversation would change. Because before that, they were just talking to some kid, and now they're reminiscing about their friend, or somebody they were a fan of. And it was fascinating to get Sheldon Mayer stories from other people who knew him.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, and just same thing. I for a long time, I was the biggest Bill Finger fan anybody ever knew. Bill Finger's the actual creator of Batman.
Right.
And when I started doing Nuff Said, I started meeting a lot of people who are much bigger Bill Finger fans than I am, because they all knew him. And they had these incredible stories. And it seems that the more you knew Bill Finger, the more you liked him. And your grandfather's the same way. The more people knew Sheldon Mayer, the more they liked him. And of course, there's always going to be a couple exceptions, and there were.
Well, he didn't. One thing he didn't do well was pretend, and he didn't kiss Tookus very well. So if he thought somebody was an idiot, it would be a little bit difficult. He just didn't lie on any level, and he wouldn't be mean necessarily, but he wouldn't bother.
Yeah, yeah.
So if he took the time,
there were some idiots that we used to talk about. and it's interesting because there was an Irwin Hayes and art exhibit,
and
Shelley and I went to a coffee later afterwards, and we were starting to talk. And it's interesting because totally different groups of people that he considered idiots. But he loved. And we are coming very close to the end of this show. It is like 11 of. And there is so much because we've got the entire history of comics to talk about. And I did want to get to some of the stuff that Jim Salicrup is editing and publishing, because you've clearly shown in this last hour and a half how much you love the medium of comics and how much you love the art form. And a lot of people listening probably until this hour and a half thought that comics were superheroes and they were synonymous with superheroes. And we're reminding people that there's more to comics than superheroes. And we've only barely touched on the great variety of stuff that Paper Cuts and your other imprint is doing.
Super genius.
I mean, you found some Neil Gaiman comics that kind of were forgotten.
In a nutshell, there was a company called Techno Comics in the early 90s that hired a bunch of high-profile creators to create characters for them. There was a hotshot new writer on the scene, Neil Gaiman, they said, why don't you create a character for us? And knowing an opportunity, when he sees one, he created five characters for them, and they published three titles based on those characters. They hired other writers and artists to do the material, and some of it turned out exceptionally well, you know, particularly Mr. Hero and Technophage. And because, yeah, when the boom came in the 90s and a lot of companies fell by the wayside, that material has sort of been in limbo for, you know, many years now. We were able to track down the Techno people who owned the rights to it and collect them and I think very handsome hardcover editions. Mm-hmm. And I think even something like Technophage, which was written by Rick Veitch, benefits being collected because there was a lot of continuity from issue to issue. And having it all in one book, you could see what he was doing. And there was a lot of great artwork done. There was a lot of, you know, good comics mixed in there. When I spoke to Neil about, you know, wanting to, you know, collect that material, you know, he very modestly, you know, nods his head and goes, yeah, there was a lot of good little stories in there. I think he was happy to see this. But that's the story with a lot of what we're doing. We're doing a combination of, anything that we think we could, that we think is good and worth getting out there. And, we did we mentioned the Super Genius imprint a lot. That was, after several years of just doing comics for all ages and then seeing so many other publishers, once we were kind of being very successful at it, hop on that bandwagon. Mm-hmm. For one little statistic, you know, there's a website called ICV2. It's sort of a newsletter, trade comics trade website, and the guy that runs it, you know, is, you know, tries to collect as much data as possible. And 10 years ago, when they would do reports on, you know, the comic book market, you know, kids comics weren't even a category.
Right.
In recent years, it's now become 10% of the comics market, you know, because there are those properties like Adventure Time and others that do, or even My Little Pony, that have both kid audience and, you know, sort of a cult, you know, adult audience as well. So it's growing and growing, and that's, I think, good news. I think, you know, comics, there's so much potential. There always has been. And I think the best years are still ahead. And the greatest thing that could happen is to have as much variety as possible. That's what we strive for in our own little way.
What's your website?
It's www.papercuts, one word with a Z at the end, .com. And you can see all the amazing things we're doing.
And my everything is Peaceful Shades.
PeacefulShades.com.
Yes. Yep. And my YouTube, my Facebook, Twitter, Instagram is all Peaceful Shades.
peacefulshades.com. So that's Shelley Mayer, granddaughter of Sheldon Mayer. And
and I'm Jim Salakrup, grandson of Jim Salakrup.
Dun, dun, dun.
And there is so much variety to this art form, and I'm so glad that Jim is doing so much of it. Thank you,
Kim, for this opportunity.
I mean, you know, going to Europe to find material. Everybody else is going to Japan. You're going to Europe.
There's so many. In 2 seconds, I'll try to say. Do you remember when you were a kid something called Children's Digest?
Children's Digest. No.
It was a magazine for kids, and they used to serialize Tintin. In the U.S. And they would be on this weird tinted paper. Anyway, you know, there's always been other stuff available. Yeah. It's just a matter of knowing how to find it.
Yes, knowing how to find it and then making it available here. And the fact that your stuff is sold in comic book stores and bookstores and online is also because, you know, we can sit here on WBAI and tell people how great it is, and then people go, well, how do I find it? Especially comic shops are so limited in what they're willing to stock.
Well, there is Amazon. You know, they have everything,
and
at pretty good discounts too.
So there's a lot of ways of getting this material. So go to papercuts.com, papercuts with a Z. Look over what he has, and know that it's not there because this will meet this trend or that trend. It's there because Jim likes it. And I think that's the best criteria of all.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really appreciative of this opportunity. I share your love of comics, and I also appreciate what you've done over the years. I want to go over your archives and listen to some of those classic interviews.
I used to always say, all eras, all styles. That's what Nuff Said did. And after I got off the phone with you, and you would give me the list of the whole page of notes, and I'm like, all eras, all styles. That's kind of what you've got, because you've got several different eras that you're making available again, and several different styles. So that means that most people aren't going to like every single solitary thing you put out, but everybody's going to like something you put out.
I hope so. It's worth exploring. It's like, you know, it's kind of sad to go to a comic book convention and meet so many people who aren't reading comics, you know. And I understand it. Some of their it's fun to be a cosplayer. It's fun to, you know, they're there because they've seen the movies. But you know, it would be nice to, you know, get people going to comic book conventions and looking for new comics to read.
Yeah, touche. And I've got a song. Shelley just showed me a drawing she did. Of
you.
Yours truly. I did recognize it. Very strange drawing. My wife is listening and going, hey, I want to see that.
There's a nearly naked man in the room, by the way.
Yes, there is a nearly naked man in the room. Yes, Lister is here. He's going to be bringing you Burn Baby Burn in just a few more minutes. An absolutely wonderful reggae show. And again, as what
the wonders of radio.
Wonders
I
of
love
radio.
New York.
And I chose a song to go out for transitioning to the next show, based on what's going on in the world right now, and based on the very first comic book that Jim Salakrup ever edited.
Which was
about
Alice Cooper.
Ooh.
And so here we have Alice Cooper. And thank you, Jim. Thank you, Shelley.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a wonderful hour and a half. It seemed like 10 minutes, but it really was an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of Hour of the Wolf, with your truly substituting for Jim Foyne, I'm Ken Gale. You can hear all of it on our website in about 5 or 10 minutes. It'll be at WBAI.org. And now is Burn Baby Burn with Lister. And, I have to fill some more. So I'm just going to thank Jim and Shelly one more time for the wonderful hour and a half we just had. And I thank Jim Foyne again for letting me sit in on your show, because I had a wall on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm pissing your tax. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit.
quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. Gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
'99.5 WBAI. Now I'm going to sound like Abdi Selassie. And and now I'm going to sound like Terry Wilson. And now I'm going to sound like Abdi Selassie and Terry Wilson in one. And just laugh at the situation here at 99.5 WBAI where none of the equipment works. The CD1 is dead. And CD2 refuses to play. So, we're going to try again. Maybe if somebody came in the studio and threw water all over the equipment, then it would really, really work. Burn, baby, burn style, wouldn't it? All right, here we go again. One more time. Nothing works. That's dead. That's dead. That's dead. That's dead. Okay, let's try another Abdi Selassie trick and see what works. Okay. The land of dead air. But it's not polluted, it's just recycled. All right, let's see. One more time. Do, 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 do. Yep. So, I guess this is the reason why they have fundraising time at 99.5 WBAI. Because the bloody equipment does not function. And this is all the time it's going to take for one little CD to work. And here it goes. And we're just going to play one CD throughout the entire show. One CD player. Here we go. This is gonna be rough, but I hope you enjoy it.
Hey, make a change, yeah. Today, that's what I said. That's what I said. Change it, change it, change it, change it. Let them
running, running.